Hello, this is Meet the Writers. My guest this week has written for most of the UK and Irish national newspapers. Three of his books have featured as Radio 4's Book of the Week. His writing's been compared to Bill Bryson. He's covered everything from football to Joy Division. His most recent book, Last Train to Hilversum, explores our relationship with the medium of radio. Charlie Connolly, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you.
Your book, your latest book, The Last Train to Hilversum, is a journey in search of the magic of radio. And I wondered where that journey started for you. Were you always a radio listener?
I am. I am a lifelong radio listener, for actually longer than I remember, because one of the things that prompted me to write the book was my mum unearthed a postcard that I'd been sent when I was 5 years old from Listen With Mother, which kind of ages me a bit, thanking me for a picture I'd drawn of the Jumblies that they said they're going to put on their office wall. And so every time I go in the BBC now, every time I pass an office, I sort of have a look in the office, see if they're still up there, you know, because they definitely put it up on the wall and didn't put it in the bin with all the others. So yeah, so from before I can remember, I must have been listening to the radio with my mum. Don't remember listening to Listen With Mother, but I've been through all the kind of classic stuff of the transistor radio under the pillow, listening to John Peel, and then you sort of get into Radio 1, and then as you get older, you go on to Radio 4. So I wake up to Radio 4 now. So yeah, it's a lifelong relationship with radio for me. Mm. As for everyone, really, because one of the most astonishing statistics I found was that, according to Radar, 90% of the adult population of Britain listens to the radio every week, not just once a year. 90% of adults are listening to the radio every week, which I think is an astonishing figure.
And that's proper analogue radio.
It is, yeah. It's not including podcasts, anything like that. I mean, makes you wonder what the other 10% are doing, to be honest. I think we ought to have a word with them. But yeah, 9 out of 10 adults, that's what, about 40 million people in Britain listening to the radio every week? That's something worth celebrating, I think, because you know, my life journey in radio, from Listening With Mother up to the present, is the same for everyone else, it seems. 9 out of 10 people, anyway.
Mm. And, of course, you were writing along the way, and you've got this kind of huge backlist, your bibliography. How many books have you actually written? Do you know?
I don't know. That sounds terrible.
I mean, it basically covers everything from sport to Elvis Presley.
Yeah. Yeah, I started out writing about football. I wrote a few books about football, and then I wrote a book where I followed Liechtenstein's national football team through their World Cup qualifying campaign.
Why?
Well, I'm a lifelong football fan, and it was around the time when the Premier League was getting huge and huge sums of money were going into football, and I thought it was losing a bit of its soul. So I wanted to find a team that were still pretty much playing for the love of it, and Liechtenstein having a population of about 35,000 people and still managing to put out an international team against teams like England and Spain and Germany in the same competitions. And most of them still had day jobs. I think they only had one professional footballer when I was there. So the rest of them were working in the post office, working in banks. And so I went to see if I could still find the real soul of sport and the soul of football in the Alps, and I kind of found it.
That was, I think, your fifth book, and your first five were all about football.
They were, yeah. I mean, I started out writing for, there was a big movement of football fanzines that sprang up in the late 80s, and I was in my late teens then, so, and thinking about what I wanted to do, and I was a massive football fan, and I wanted to write about football, so I started a football fanzine, and so I wrote match reports for local teams for the local papers as well. And then eventually, after a roundabout route, I ended up writing books about football as well. And then I started travelling to write books about football, you know, such as the Liechtenstein one. And from there, I kind of progressed into more general travel books without going to football matches in between.
Mm. Well, let's talk about your sixth book, because this would appear to be the first time that we're really seeing you focus in on radio, because it's called Attention All Shipping, A Journey Round the Shipping Forecast.
Yeah.
And for anybody who's not familiar with the shipping forecast, well, let's hear a snippet of one.
Another shipping forecast, issued by the Met Office at 2343 on Saturday the 18th. There are warnings of gales in all areas except Trafalgar. The general synopsis at 1800, low 200 miles south of Iceland, 960, drifting slowly east and filling.
Charlie, tell us a little bit about the shipping forecast.
The shipping forecast is a weather forecast broadcast by the BBC for the seas around Britain and all the way up to Iceland, Norway, and down as far as Portugal as well. And it goes out four times a day at the same times every day, has done in its present form, or something resembling its present form, since 1924. And it's one of the few real iron horses of the broadcasting schedule that's really lasted that long. And it's a tremendous thing. It's got this huge cultural resonance that goes beyond just a weather forecast. People listen to it who've got no connection to the sea. I mean, I wrote that book about 2004 it came out, I think. And I still get emails from people who've read it, and they live in places like Wolverhampton. You know, they're nowhere near the sea, but they've got this same kind of cultural attachment to the shipping forecast because it's really got under our skin, I think. If you stop someone in the street and ask them to name six of the sea areas, they could probably do it without too much difficulty. And Dogger and Fisher would always be two of them. It always seems to be the ones that people remember. But they probably wouldn't be able to tell you the last time they'd listened to the shipping forecast, but it's got this real cultural resonance that has got sort of soaked into the fabric of the country, really. And I think the shipping forecast is one of the things that shows Britain its best, because it's kind of altruistic. You don't make a profit from the shipping forecast. It's there to save lives at sea. And it's outward-looking as well. I think a lot of the things we celebrate about Britain tend to be inward-looking. Yet the shipping forecast is looking out from our shores, and it's looking after sailors up near Iceland, and it's looking out for sailors down near Portugal. And I think that's a really terrific thing and worth celebrating. And long may it continue.
And so how did your book explore that?
Well, I set out to visit each of there's 31 sea areas that they divide the sea up around our shores into these 31 areas. And there's a poem by a poet called Sean Street who describes the shipping forecast map as paving the water, which I think is a really, really lovely image. And so I decided to visit each of them in order, in the way that they're read, because it's read out in the same order, every shipping forecast. And I decided to go to each one in the order they're read out. So I started out right up in Norway, and went to the island of Utsira, because you've got the regions North Utsira and South Utsira. And when I turned up on Utsira, the people there were absolutely baffled as to why an English fellow was turning up, jabbering about the radio. It was a fun weekend in Utsira, and it's kind of set the tone for it was a really fascinating journey where I met some really interesting people and saw some interesting places that I wouldn't have done if it hadn't been for the shipping forecast map.
So from one of the most calming things to listen to somebody who really made us all, well, jump and twist and shout, and that's Elvis Presley. You wrote In Search of Elvis, A Journey to Find the Man Beneath the Jumpsuit. Did you find him?
I found several Elvises, actually. Yeah. I mean, that came out in 2007, which was the 30th anniversary of Elvis's death. And so I thought I'd set out on this kind of global odyssey to find people who were still keeping the spirit of Elvis alive. And so I went to Canada, and in Montreal I found the Orthodox Jewish Elvis impersonator who calls himself Schmelvis, which I think that's the best thing ever. And there's an Anglican priest over there as well who started his own church, and he calls himself Elvis Priestley. And so I met all these incredible people like that. But because Elvis, people have a real personal connection to Elvis like they don't with any other artist, really. It really is personal. And when you meet the impersonators, I mean, some of them are better than others, let's be frank. But they all feel like the spirit of Elvis is upon them when they're performing. And I really admire that. And however cheap their jumpsuits are, however bulging their waistlines are, to go and see a festival of Elvis impersonators, it's a really heartwarming thing.
Mm. Now, do you have some kind of Irish background?
I do, yes. Yeah, it's, with the name Connolly, it couldn't really be anything else.
I'd forgotten that bit. But yeah. Mostly I was referring to the fact that you've written a couple of books about Ireland, in fact.
Mm, yes, I moved to Ireland in 2008, and I went to live in Dublin because the woman who's now my wife was living in Dublin as well. So I moved there for that. And I'd always been fascinated by my own heritage, or fascinated in that I didn't know anything about it. And so I started to explore my genealogy because my dad didn't really know much about it. And it turns out that it goes back much further to my great-great-great-grandfather. He was a guy called John Connolly, who arrived in London in 1843. And so I wrote a book called Our Man in Hibernia, which was about me moving to Ireland and exploring the place. And I took courses in the Irish language and all that kind of, because I think the way into a culture and a country is through language, cuisine and sport, I'd say, are three of the real strong ones. So I took Irish language classes, and when you meet Irish people, they're forced to learn the Irish language at school. So when I said I'd come along and I volunteered to sign up for night classes in Irish, the looks I got were, let's say, incredulous, and some of the words they used when they were probably unrepeatable. But it is a beautiful language, and I spent 4 years then in Ireland and Dublin's a fantastic city. And that book kind of detailed a sort of innocent abroad, in a way, me kind of finding my way in a country that was having a hard time. It was 2008, and the island officially went into recession 3 weeks after I arrived. So I kind of felt a bit responsible. But yeah, so that was that book. And I learnt more about my family heritage and even found the tiny townland in Cork where my great-great-grandfather John Connolly had left from when he went to London in the 1840s. So yeah, that was a very personal one, that one.
Mm, and you also wrote about the history of not only Ireland, but Britain too.
Mm, yes, I did a book. I think history is about getting out into the landscape. It's a really good way of understanding history is getting out there and seeing the places where historic events happened. And I thought one way to do that would be if I followed great journeys from history. So I wrote a book called And Did Those Feet, where I picked out some of the most significant historical journeys in the history of these islands, basically. And I did, for example, King Harold in 1066, when he'd won the Battle of Stamford Bridge and seen off the Viking threat for good, pretty much. It was the last time we had a Viking threat in this country, only to get the news that William had landed at Pevensey and was marching towards London. So Harold got his army and he had to march all the way down from Yorkshire. Stamford Bridge is about 8 miles east of York. And he had to march all the way south and to meet them for the battle at the place that's now called Battle. So I walked that journey. And I think it gives you, because in the history books, the journeys that great figures make are kind of glossed over in a few sentences. But when you spend 2.5 weeks, or whatever it was, from walking from Yorkshire to the south coast, and you can really sort of put yourself in Harold's shoes, thinking what he'd just come from, what he was up against. And those 2 weeks were kind of one of the biggest turning points in the history of Britain. And I think those kind of journeys are often overlooked and glossed over when you read biographies, but they're hugely important. So I did that journey. I did Boudicca coming out of Norfolk to ransack Colchester in London. And then she went up to St. Albans and ransacked St. Albans, which I think is a bit unfair on St. Albans. But yeah, then she vanished into history. So I walked all those journeys. And I think walking through the landscape is such a great way to get an understanding of a place and its history and culture.
And you were out in the landscape and in the wind and rain once again for your book Bring Me Sunshine, oh, yeah, which was all about weather.
Yes, yeah. We, as British people, we talk, and Irish people as well, we talk a lot about the weather. And it's, you know, you stand at a bus stop next to someone you've never met before, you'll comment on how cold it is. Yet we don't really know much about how we get the weather forecast, how the weather actually works, what happens up there in the sky above our heads to bring us the snow and the rain and the sunshine. So I set out to understand, or attempt to understand that, and write about some of the kind of crackpots, geniuses and charlatans that were behind the weather forecast we know today. And I found it quite gratifying in that we don't really know exactly what the weather's going to do. We're quite spoilt these days with the technology and the scientific advances we've made. And the weather forecasting is an incredible science, and it's a huge achievement in its own right. But I quite like the fact that it's often wrong, because I think that it kind of gives us a sense of perspective. You know, we're not getting carried away. And there were times when people thought they'd really defeat nature, you know, by cloud seeding and making rain and things like that. But we can't do it. The weather always wins. Nature always wins.
Mm, that's so true. You returned to music, and having done a book on Elvis, you now went to really something that couldn't be more different, Joy Division and New Order.
Yeah, actually, I co-wrote Bernard Sumner's autobiography, Chapter and Verse. And it was kind of a bizarre story because Joy Division and New Order, obviously two of the most important groups in British music. And one day I was sitting at home and I got an email through my website from someone saying they were Bernard Sumner from Joy Division and New Order, and saying that he'd really enjoyed a couple of my books. He was a big fan of them, and, you know, keep up the good work kind of thing. And obviously I thought, this is some kind of wind up. This is one of my daft mates trying to sucker me in. But it wasn't. It actually was Bernard. And we exchanged a few emails, and then I went over to stay with him at his house in Cheshire. And he's always been a very private person. And eventually he decided he wanted to write his autobiography, and he asked me to help him with that. And that was an incredible experience. He's a very, very articulate man, very intelligent, and a natural storyteller. And this is a guy who's been at the centre of British popular music, certainly since punk happened. You know, the Joy Division started in sort of 78, and New Order are still touring now, making records now, all these years later. So it was an incredible life, and it was a real privilege to sit there listening to him telling me his story and me writing it down and putting it into something a bit more literary. And it was the first book I'd ever kind of ghostwritten. And it was a really terrific experience because it's an incredible story. I mean, people sometimes criticize celebrities for having their books ghostwritten. But if you've got a good story, you want it told in the best way possible. Mm. And you know, you might not be a natural writer. So to get someone in who can put things into sentences for you, I think it's a natural thing. And writing a book isn't just telling your life story. It's got to be structured in the right way to get the best out of the story and the most consistent level through the story and the highlights and what have you. So yeah, that was that. That was my first venture into ghostwriting, was with Bernard, who tells me still today, he reminds me that I'm the only person he's ever sent a fan letter to.
Which is, and look what happened.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, it's quite a responsibility to carry through.
Absolutely. Now, you've written a lot on cricket too.
Yeah, I'm a big cricket fan. And one day, another email I got through my website a few years ago was from the editor of Wisden's Cricket Almanac, which, for people who don't know, is the Bible of cricket that comes out every year. It's a little yellow half brick of a book that's been going since 1864. And it is the be-all and end-all of cricket statistics and cricket writing as well. And the editor of Wisden that year was a guy called Shield Berry. And he had enjoyed a couple of my books. And in one of them, I've mentioned I like cricket. So he asked me if I'd like to write something for the Wisden Cricket Almanac, which I get the Wisden every year. It's the pinnacle of writing. Well, certainly it's probably the proudest thing I've ever done is writing for Wisden that year. I think it was the 2011 edition. And as a result of that, I put together a book on strange stories from cricket around the world, which was called Elk Stopped Play, because believe it or not, in Finland in a match once, an elk stopped play by wandering across the field. So I put together this global selection of stories that had appeared in Wisden over the years. And then after that, I wrote a book about W.G. Grace, who is probably still the greatest cricketer probably the world has ever produced. He was a Victorian and he dominated the sport like nobody else. He was probably the first modern sports superstar because he advertised things like Coleman's mustard. And although he was supposed to be an amateur, he took some very healthy expenses when he went anywhere else. And so it was the centenary of his death in 2015. And so I wrote a novella. I didn't realize I'd written a novella until the Guardian reviewed it and called it a novella. But I basically wrote the last years of his life sort of from his perspective in a diary form. So it was almost, I was verging on fiction there, but thankfully had still had the anchors in nonfiction to keep me going from wildly off topic. But yes, and that book was shortlisted for the MCC Cricket Book of the Year. It didn't win, didn't deserve to win, but that's one of my proudest things I've done as well, was getting shortlisted for that.
Let's come back to radio now and this most recent book, which is so interesting. It's called The Last Train to Hilversum, and Hilversum has a special resonance for anybody who is interested in radio. Tell us why.
When radios were first introduced, instead of just numbers and along the dial, you'd often have the place names, which were basically the transmitters across Europe and beyond. So you'd have, some of them were very well known, places you'd recognise, you'd have Paris or Lisbon, places like that. But some of them were places I certainly would struggle to point to on a map, places like Lahti and Kalundborg, and Daventry was a very popular one because the big BBC transmitter was at Daventry. But Hilversum was always on them as well. And for some reason, that word really stuck in my mind. And when I came to write the book, I've got a sense that we're at a sort of tipping point, a sort of watershed in the history of radio, because the analog switch off is coming and we're going to get all our radio through digital means before too long. And that's a great thing because it's moving radio forward. And as I said, 9 out of 10 people are listening to the radio. So radio is more popular really than it's ever been. But I think it's worth stepping back and taking stock of where radio's come from as well. The pop and the crackle and the hiss are all part of our culture really. And radio is still less than 100 years old in terms of broadcasting. And so I thought I'd explore that and at the same time find out where Hilversum was and see if I could make my way there on a journey through sort of some of the great moments in radio and some of the most interesting people making radio at the moment. And for some reason, the phrase Last Train to Hilversum came into my head. I thought that would be a good thing to call the book. I'm still worried that I've pinched that from someone else because it's a very creative phrase for me to come up with. So I'm worried I'm going to get a solicitor's letter that this Last Train to Hilversum was... Yeah, but...
Oh, dear. So tell us then. I mean, take us back to the beginning.
Oh, wow. I mean, radio started out almost more of a point-to-point communication method. And it was Guglielmo Marconi who really kind of probably wasn't the first person to think of it, but was the first person to really explore the idea of broadcasting, that you wouldn't just, you know, send messages to people out at sea or whatever and get messages back. You could send out music and chat and comedians and news into the ether for people to pick up on their radio sets. And it really took off in the 1920s. And when I was writing the book, I mean, it really struck me that it must have been absolutely magical back then, that you could have this box in your living room and hear a dance band from London, or, you know, an opera from, I mean, people would tune in to the European stations, so you could listen to an opera from Luxembourg you could pick up on your radio at home. The BBC had the monopoly back in the 20s, but not in terms of what people could listen to. They had the monopoly in Britain, but you could still tune into all these European stations as well. I kind of investigated some of the more interesting personalities from back then as well, and found some incredible stories of people. And I just think it's radio is a magical thing. It's a great cultural achievement. It's a great scientific achievement as well. And I don't think radio celebrates itself enough. It's a very self-effacing medium, I think, by nature. I mean, TV is everywhere and TV personalities are everywhere. But radio just quietly gets on with it and succeeds. And it's going from strength to strength. And that's something I really wanted to get across in the book as well, that radio is worth celebrating. And we don't do that enough.
Is it going from strength to strength, and can you call podcasting radio?
I think you can call podcasting radio. It's just a different form of radio. I mean, I listen to radio programs in podcast form, and so when I listen to that, does that suddenly stop being radio because I've downloaded it onto my phone? I think the future of radio, I mean, people are saying podcasting is going to kill radio. Podcasting isn't going to kill radio. Everything since the 1920s was supposed to kill radio. Television was supposed to kill radio. Cinema was supposed to kill radio. But radio's still there, and it's still battling away successfully. So I think radio is surviving, and I think podcasting, audio, I mean, the amount of ways we can listen to radio now, the devices we have, tablets, phones, you can still get it on your radio, PCs and laptops. There's so many options for listening to radio. It can only be successful. Mm. I think with podcasting, the only disadvantage I think with podcasting is you lose that sense of discovery, because you're going in search of something listening to a podcast. It's like, oh, there's a podcast about great books. I'd listen to that because I'm interested in great books. Whereas if you listen to the radio and just leave the radio on in the kitchen for a couple of hours, you're going to hear things you never expected to hear, that you'd never have found out for yourself and gone to look for. So I think that's where radio scores over podcasting, I think, is that sense of discovery.
Absolutely. I got completely suckered into listening to something about how a pothole is formed the other day. I would never have thought that out, but wow, it was interesting.
Well, next time I fall down one, I'll have to seek that out.
Lord Reith, of course, and the formation of the BBC was very much a part of what we think of as mainstream radio.
Mm, yeah. I mean, he was an extraordinary character, Reith. Huge 6'5" dour Presbyterian from the east coast of Scotland, and an incredible character. And his influence and personality are still detectable when you go into, if you go into Broadcasting House in London, you can almost feel his steely gaze on the back of your neck. I mean, he was what the BBC needed at the time. He became the first Director General. And he was a man of great ego. He knew he was destined for great things. He had a sense that he was destined for great things. And when he applied for the job at the Director Generalship of the BBC, he saw it first as a kind of stepping stone to something much better. Well, I don't know if he wanted to be Prime Minister or what, but so much so that he applied for the job, went for the interview and got the job despite not actually knowing what broadcasting was. He completely winged the interview, but by sheer force of personality, he became the first Director General. And he formed the BBC in the image that we still know it today. And by extension, radio and broadcasting as we know it today as well. He was a very, very complex character, very moralistic, especially with his family. Yet he fell short of his own moralistic codes far too often to make them kind of plausible in the end. But a really incredible character. But just what radio and the BBC needed at the time, a strong personality to take it by the scruff of the neck and lead it through, rather than having loads of committees and meetings. And it was very much in his image. And the legacy's still there today, I think. Maybe in some ways we need another Lord Reith today.
Absolutely. I mean, people talk about how public radio is dying. Do you think that that's a valid criticism?
No, I don't think it is. I think certainly in Britain, public radio news is getting a lot of criticism at the moment because I think it tries to preserve its independence, but by that it's giving equal weight to arguments that shouldn't be given equal weight. So I think that there's a weakness there. And I think because the BBC certainly is under so much external pressure from other media organisations in particular, because there's no advertising, there's no editorial control from one person, that is, the BBC's getting a bit scared of its own shadow, I think. And if it can get through that, I think it can come through stronger, and public radio in Britain certainly can remain. I think Britain needs a strong public radio. I think every country kind of needs a strong public radio, as a strong commercial section as well. There's room for everything. But I think public radio is safe enough. I think there's enough there. There's enough talented people there and enough dedicated people to hopefully shrug off a lot of the criticism that comes its way. And a lot of that criticism is justified, absolutely. But I think it's going to come through it. And the BBC, certainly, in terms of public radio, will survive at a national and local level as well, because the BBC provides some very good local stations, which have provided a terrific service. So the fact there's no direct editorial control like you have with a newspaper owner or what have you, I think is a very healthy thing.
I used to work on shortwave radio, which was necessary because, of course, there was no internet and you couldn't reach people who were far away. The internet has revolutionised global listening.
It has. I mean, I listen to most of my radio through the internet now. If I'm sitting at my desk, I'll have it on in the background through the laptop. And there's so much variety, and it's, you know, most of it's in terms of technical aspects, it's crystal clear as well. You're not getting that hiss and flutter. And there are stations, I mean, I found this tremendous thing called the Radio Garden. Have you seen this? It's an app, and you can get it on a website as well. And it's the globe appears, this sheet of green dots spreads across the globe, and it's all the internet radio stations that you can listen to. And if you can zoom in on a place, and as you zoom in, it does the old kind of sound of a radio tuning, an old-fashioned radio tuning, but then you alight on a place in, say, I don't know, the Faroe Islands or something like that, and suddenly Faroese radio is coming through the internet at you. It's a brilliant thing. I mean, I spent hours on it just surfing around the world, basically. And I wouldn't be able to do that before the internet or without the internet. So, I mean, internet radio makes local radio international and global. So you can eavesdrop on a Greenland station or a station in the south of France and hear what people are worried about, what they're phoning in about, and what music they're listening to. So I think the internet has been a terrific thing for radio.
This book is so fabulous. It's a social history, it's a travelogue, it's a wonderful examination of this medium that I, and I'm sure our listeners, love because they are listeners. And I would absolutely urge people to pick it up because you have so many wonderful stories about some of the really big characters, a lot of historical detail, and just really at the core of it, this real love of radio. So as you say in your book, we are all radio people. Charlie, thank you so much for coming on to speak to us. Last Train to Hilversum is by Charlie Connolly, A Journey in Search of the Magic of Radio. It's published by Bloomsbury and it's out now. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.